seriously considering asking him to leave.
Is it really that bad? Melissa was surprised by Stephanie offloading like this. They were not generally so open with each other about their relationships. She wondered if she knew about Michael's recent defection from Paradise. Had Damien told her?
It's about as bad as it's ever been, she said. We don't see eye to eye on anything anymore. He doesn't help me. You saw what happened with Avril earlier when I was trying to get her into the pool. Whatever I'm trying to do, he comes in and makes it harder, and in front of the kids too. He refuses to form a united front with me. I'm just trying to help her get over this fear she has. I don't understand where it's come from. She didn't used to be like this. She used to love the water, and now suddenly she's terrified of it.
Did something happen to make her scared of water?
No, not that I know of.
Rhea's scared of toilets. There's something about water that's frightening to them, maybe. The way it swells up and overflows.
Maybe.
Stephanie leaned her head back against the headrest and looked out of the window at the boundless, hot blue sky, the hills of ivory sand, and the ocean appearing and disappearing as they went. Her mind was full of all the things she wanted to say to Damien, but would not be able to remember when she set eyes on him again, and resumed the struggle of being in his company. She forgot all about the map reading.
Wait, are we supposed to turn off soon? Oh, shit! Sorry!
They ended up in a different supermercado to the one they'd intended, in the next town. It was full of salmon-coloured Brits in shorts. They cruised the aisles of Mediterranean fruit, the heat-softened apples and the Italian salami. They found a friendly system. Stephanie pushed the trolley and Melissa fetched sausages, burgers, cereal, red stripe, vodka. There was a barbecue planned for the final night. The idea was to save some of the alcohol until then, but the likelihood was that they would have to restock. Hazel and Pete drank like fishes.
I think I agree with you about the village, Melissa said when they were driving back. Stephanie had been talking again about Damien, this time in a calmer way, more resigned. She had been interested to hear that Melissa had been going through a similar thing, and impressed that it had led to an actual split, if only temporary.
Aren't things better now, though, after some time apart? You seem happy. You always do.
Please don't say we're chocolate.
What?
That's what Hazel always calls us.
Oh, no, I wasn't going to say that.
Things are better, I guess, Melissa said. But they're the same as well. It's the same problems. Life consumes us. We get caught up in it and forget about each other. Sometimes I think we're just fundamentally not enough. He's too much for me, and I'm not enough for him. Or the other way round, I don't know.
It must be that, what you were saying.
Relationships and children simply don't belong in the same place.
It's because we want to do things our way, how we see fit, Stephanie said, instead of some big hairy man coming along and messing everything up.
They both laughed. And Damien was so extremely hairy, she added.
You have to live with these things. You put up with them. What for?
But say there were these two separate villages, Melissa said, slowing towards a roundabout. Isn't it a bit unfair, the kids staying with the women? Why wouldn't they stay with the men? Why should we get dumped with all the work?
Because they belong with us. They came from us.
You sound like my mum. That's just what you've been taught.
No, it's true.
Women and men. We've all been given this old script and don't know how to let go of it. It seems indestructible almost. We're stuck. We're all stuck. We haven't moved forwards at all in some ways. Society makes patriarchs of decent men.
Oh, listen to you, Susan Sontag or Jermaine Greer or whatever your name is. Are you sure you're not the one with the script? See, I've always steered clear of feminism because they're always so het up about everything instead of just getting on with their lives and just living, you know? It might have done a lot for women in the long run, but I think an essential thing it's taken away from us, or at least contested in us, is an innocence of instinct. They talk about choice, yet they seem to look down on a woman's choice to prioritize her children, as if she's been forced into it. I'm not oppressed. My children don't oppress me. They free me. It's the man that's the problem.
Melissa did not see it that way. But she liked the boldness of Stephanie's thinking, this great freedom inside of her. She admired her ability to exist, loose from external expectation. She didn't care what anyone thought. She had a pure singularity of purpose, and there was contentment and safety in that. She was a solid, straight house. It was not crooked, and it would not fall down. All I'm saying, she concluded, is that things don't necessarily have to be the way they've been put.
Okay, Gloria Steinem. And by the way, men have been given their oppressive pre-assigned roles as well, you know. It's not just us.
Yes, but it's easier to settle into the dominant position than the inferior one. They drove the rest of the way in silence, listening to Spanish radio. It was a warm silence, with waves of understanding and connection going through it. When they got back to the villa, the activity in the garden had shifted from lounging in the sun to doing press-ups and sit-ups on the grass in some kind of testosterone-fueled strength competition, in which Pete was in the lead and Damien and Michael were clambering somewhere behind. Damien was sweating profusely, the hair on his short legs clinging to his shin bones, for he was not, and never really had been, a man of exercise. He was only joining in because he felt compelled to compete with Pete, no matter how futile and ludicrous an idea this was. When he saw Stephanie and Melissa entering the garden with the shopping, he exerted himself even harder with his 19th press-up, though Michael was less eager to impress, and at the extremity of the press-up, collapsed and flopped over onto his back, panting. Spurred by this demonstration of his friend's apparent physical inferiority, Damien soldiered on, right to the 40th punishing push, by which time the women had disappeared into the kitchen. Damien had not seen or spoken to Melissa until that dawn meeting at Stansted, since the night of the snow. He had taken back with him to Dorking otherworldly memories of their white cocoon, their secret hours with Millie Jackson and Susanna Backer, their intimate smoking in the garden by the black tree, and that lasting image of her at the bottom of the stairs in the early morning, looking so wild and sweet, just out of sleep. For weeks and weeks, he had been falling asleep next to Stephanie and thinking of Melissa. Not in an obvious way, purer than that, more profound. He wanted to help her find her lost angel. Every day, he thought about leaving, to go and live on his own, to find his own lost angel. And once, he almost had left, in the middle of a Wednesday night. He had taken a suitcase out of the cupboard under the stairs and started to pack. He had even got as far as writing part of a note to leave on the bedside table for Stephanie, but Avril had woken up and come out of her room and asked him what he was doing, and the sight of her, her creased pyjamas, her sullen face, as if waiting to be hurt, had stopped him. The needfulness of his children, the shattering of their perfect normalcy, and his fixture within it. He had put everything back where it belonged and thrown the note away. After that, he had continued on as usual, work and back, the long, imprisoning weekend, falling asleep to thoughts of Melissa, who now was almost a phantom in his mind, swollen and blindingly bright, with special powers, such as the ability to float and twirl in mid-air. It was difficult then, this sudden domestic proximity to her, in the morning, in the evening, in the afternoon, especially in the night, when she lay just across the hall in her stripy vest and shorts pajama set, which he had seen when she was coming out of the bathroom yesterday. It was difficult also in the presence of both Michael and Stephanie, neither of whom should sniff or have the faintest inclination of his discomfort. He must assume an amiable, natural ease. She must not appear singled out for him in any way. Whenever he spoke to her, he tried his best to achieve the exact right pitch of eye contact, not so little that he seemed evasive. He wanted to hold, after all, to that snowy closeness they had found, yet not so much that it became over-meaningful, which of course it was to him, which was why eye contact was the trickiest thing. He tried hard to engage with the general jovial banter flying around, the constant gags and one-liners, Pete and Michael had hit it off straight away, and the two implicit shores of maleness and femaleness that had established themselves almost immediately. The men watching football on TV at siesta, the shopping having been packed away by the women, the afternoon all quiet and still, and the three of them, he, Pete, and Michael, staring at the screen as if it were the most important ball in the world, while drinking beer. How he wished to be a breaker of moulds, a different man. Hazel, admittedly, was watching it too, and at one point Melissa came in from her sunbed and stood behind the sofa, her hands leaning on the cushions, his cushion, almost touching his head. "Ah," she said after a while, watching the little long-socked men running around in the grass. "Now I understand why men like football. It's a sexual analogy. It's about trying to score and the obstacles they face along the way. It's actually all about penises." Michael was appalled. "No, it's not," he said. Damien laughed, or rather giggled. "It is," she said. "You're trying to get the ball into the net. The net is the vagina. The ball is, well, the balls. What could be closer to a metaphor for sex than that? I can't believe I haven't realised it before. No wonder men are so into it."
"And women," Pete said.
"That's right," said Hazel. "I'm not saying it's only men who like it, just that they're prone to liking it." They all carried on watching in a slightly different way, except for Michael, who was used to this two-dimensional, uninformed downgrading of the game. Hazel said, "She does have a point, though, when you think about it. In fact, most games are about scoring, getting it over the net, getting it into the net, getting it into the hole. Golf, cricket."
"Now you're being disgusting.
Chatbot, you started it."
"Yeah, but you always have to take it there, don't you?"
Hazel threw her flip-flop at Melissa's head.
"It's about technique, man," Michael said. "There's a strategy. It's mental as much as physical."
"In it," said Pete, leaning forward over his wealthy gladiator knees.
"Tactics. The route they're taking. Who they're passing to. How they're passing."
"Wait." A roar went up in the stands, then sank. There was almost a goal. The pundits chastised the culprit.
"Come on. He's not penetrating enough," Pete shouted.
"And there you have it," Melissa said. "Exactly my point." Over at the dining table on the other side of the left pillar, Stephanie was sitting with Summer, who was doing homework. Summer was writing. Stephanie was watching, her hands in her lap, waiting for any need for help, while also encouraging of the determination not to ask for help unless it was necessary. Damien wished she wasn't there. It made him more self-conscious, and it became harder for him to join in with the other men. She had hardly spoken to him since their disagreement this morning in the pool. He preferred it when he and Melissa came across each other in passing. For example, when he slipped off on his own to read for a while, as he found himself having to do quite often, the perpetual communalness being too much for him. Just before dinner that evening, he was reading Tolstoy on the landing, sitting on the top step. He was at the bit when Pierre and Prince André are having their long talk after André has returned from war, when Melissa came bouncing up the stairs after a swim, humming along to Always on Time by Ja Rule.
"Oh, hi, Damien," she said. "Reading again, I see."
"Yeah,"
he said, shyly. She smelt of the swimming pool. She was wearing her wrapper and a thin white cotton smock that was damp from her costume underneath. There was a pause, a nice, wanting-to-stay-here-chatting kind of pause.
"What is it?"
She peered as he displayed the cover.
"War and Peace. God, I had to read that for my degree. I couldn't finish it. It's just so long. Why is it so long? I gave up at around page 700, I think. I just couldn't justify the amount of time I was spending on reading just this one book. Do you know what I mean?"
It is long," he said. "It's true. But I'm enjoying it. I like Pierre."
"Is he the fat one?"
"Is he fat? I don't know."
"I think he is. That's one thing about that book I do remember. It gives a very physical sense of people. You really know what they look like."
And what they feel like, too, Damien said.
That's why I like it.
It gets right inside their heart, so you know what they're thinking, how they're responding to things, why they do the things they do. Like that scene when Natasha almost elopes with Anatole, and she gets sick afterwards because she's so humiliated. I think he does go on too much sometimes, though, in those sermons. Well, they're essays, really, on war and morality and philosophy and all that. I don't think they had proper editors in those days. That's probably why. If they had, a lot of that stuff would have been edited out. But still, I like the fact that he was bending the rules, playing with form. Who says a novel can't be an essay as well, or a sermon, or a philosophical text, or whatever?
Melissa was looking down at him patiently.
Yeah, I agree, she said. But he sensed that she was losing interest, and he had gone on for too long. Speaking of which, she gave him a light, scolding shove on the shoulder. How's yours coming along? You still haven't sent it to me.
I've looked at it.
He had, and had realised, as he had feared, that it was terrible. That there was no other more rambling, self-pitying, stilted even in its ramblingness, leaden and torturous offloading of male 20-something angst than this piece of literary shit. And this realisation had led to a newly rekindled depression lasting about 5 weeks, which had ended roughly 6 days ago, that is, as much as depressions can actually end.
And, she said, and, well, it needs work.
Okay, okay. That's good. Positive. Remember what we said, Damien? Positivity is the way to go. It's our mental landscape that holds us back.
Yes. Yes.
I've been reading Thich Nhat Hanh, she announced.
Thich Nhat who?
He's a Buddhist monk. My sister told me about him. He writes a lot about the importance of meditation and experiencing the present. You should try it. It's really been helping me with my stress and general state of mind. I've started meditating every day, or trying to stay aware of each moment, and it does make me feel calmer. It really does.
Actually, Damien said, going back to the issue of the bad novel, now that he had opened this can of failure, the stench of it was demanding more of her attention. I've been thinking of working on something completely new.
But somehow trying to relate it to Thich Nhat Hanh so that she wouldn't think he was being dismissive or self-obsessed.
You know, living in the present, letting old things go. I've been thinking I should maybe just bury that novel and write something different, in a different form. Maybe a script or something.
Sounds good, she said, ever bright, reassuring. Follow your feeling. Have faith in yourself. Then Michael came along with Blake. He had fallen asleep in his arms.
Oh, he's not sleeping, is he? What about our evening? How long's he been asleep?
Not long, Michael said, meaning since just before her swim. He had been having a red stripe with Pete under the parasol, and they'd been talking about boxing and how comfy it had been, Blake getting heavier and heavier in his lap, and how cruel it would have been to wake him up then, when the sun was setting so peachily and the air was so warm and silky. And that Beveridge was going down so cool and wet.
Well, you're going to have to wake him up, aren't you? Melissa said, in a different tone of voice, and went to take a shower. The next day, they went to the beach. Everyone, on foot, an exodus of flip-flops and beach towels and swimming apparatus and sun cream and buckets and spades bought en route from the shopping strip. The cool blue sea at the helm of the bay, the sandy shingle shore smothered largely with frying Brits. The heat was high and mighty. Ladies lay splayed in their deepening colours, sweat seeping saltish into the crevices of their thighs, and men with vast stomachs basked on their backs with their toes pointing upwards, floored by the meeting of beer and sun and breezelessness. For today there was none, only out there on the sea beneath the moving current, where the swimmers sought refuge. Brown heads bobbed among the boys. The waves had attitude, a secret pulse and a throbbing surge that sent their white frills gently crashing. Stephanie headed straight for them, once her blanket was laid down, once her children were creamed and set to making sandcastles.
I'm going for a swim, she said,
and charged out there in her flowered tankini, past the bodies, sunbeds and parasols, strode straight on into it. Melissa joined her, and they became two brown heads bobbing with the boys, very far out, so far that Blake cried, and Michael was reminded of that time in Montego Bay when she had disappeared around the ocean corner and come back laughing, as she did again, this time with Stephanie. That particular look of oceanic elation on their faces, flopping down onto their towels. Weaving among the bodies was a man selling donuts, calling,
Ah, rosquillas!
With his basket of sugared wares. They were warm and jamless, a hole in the middle, and sold well. The children, and Pete with his sweet tooth, slowly followed by the others, all together in the atrium of the heat, eating from these soft rings of sweetness, the afternoon burning on, the light making glitter on the ocean. As usual, Hazel and Pete spent much of the time sprawled next to each other with their limbs entangled, their bodies well-oiled from mutual sun-creaming, their ears almost touching, and their lips continually moist from young and superior Desdemonas. Pete had a serene and blissful look on his face. He gave a long sigh of pleasure.
Ah, this is what I'm talking about.
And Michael could not help but feel envious of him. Somewhere in the skies past Stansted and the Beatic, it seemed that Melissa had left her love suspended. Up there, in the softness of an inaccessible cloud, they were perhaps embracing still, mythologies of themselves, dream figures, still languishing on legends number 9. But down here, on Earth, the link had gradually loosened. She had called to him, like day to an evening, slipped back, stepped out. She had withdrawn her passion, changed her mind, did not come to him as Hazel went to Pete and lay her cheek in the less sinewy cushion of his shoulder. There was no original Desdemona here in the depression, only forced, scrawny likenesses. A passing peck this morning on the patio, or a caress in the forgiving wings of dawn. He wanted her to stroke his head the way Hazel did Pete's, to cream his back with that same tenderness, to treat him the way she had when he'd moved back in, clinging to him in the night, holding his face to her ribcage as if she were going to crush it. Since their reunion, he had been trying his best to make things up to her, to be a good, faithful, attentive, non-phone number collecting life partner, father and potential husband, and for a while, everything had been fine. But reality had slowly crept back in. The children, the hours spent with and without, the strangulating domesticity, and his efforts began to feel more and more draining, even futile. He lay next to her on the towel, and felt the mist of the cool droplets of water on her skin from the sea, wanting so much to reach her again, to return to their special place. "Hey," he said, touching the damp small of her back, wanting her to remember, to think of it. "How was the water, mermaid?" She looked down at him, holding back a piece of her smile. "Amazing," she said, then turned away and looked out towards the ocean. She was looking at a woman lying on a blanket further down by the water, wearing a black swimming costume. She was middle-aged, somewhere in her 40s, and sitting with her was a man of a similar age and 2 teenage girls. They all looked alike, the 4 of them. They all had straight brown hair and rosy lips, and the similarity of gesture that only happens in families. After a while, the man and the 2 girls got up and walked into the sea to swim. The woman lay there and watched them go, the sturdy stride of her man, his thickened, hairy navel, and the 2 narrow-hipped girls, thin with jutting teeth. Melissa watched her watching them, and she sensed a feeling of sorrow, a despondency, in the woman's beached body, slumped in the sand, seeing her family from a distance, this enclosure in which she lived. It was a way of watching herself from the outside, in different manifestations, and she would never escape it, this source of her love and this source of her constriction. In this woman, Melissa glimpsed a slice of her own future, one of exhaustion and deflation and imprisonment, and it repelled her. She wanted to be at the beginning of something again, rather than in the eventuality of something. Out here, in the midst of this jumbled sixum, it felt as though Michael, she and Michael,
were an old, safe place, and however high they went, to whichever number of cloud, they would always arrive back in this same safe and dusty place where there was nothing left to discover, where the future was dressed in the past.
"Don't you just love it?"
Hazel said from the next towel along, to everyone and no one in particular.
"I love this. That we can just do this, you know? Come out here like this. We should definitely do it again. Maybe next time we'll have a sproglet of our own, hey, sweetness?"
Pete murmured something in reply, opened one eye and closed it again, which Hazel took as adequately positive. She had whispered to Melissa in the bathroom last night,
"Isn't he perfect? I really think he might be the one. I really think he might be."
And the children were architects. Castles were built, moats were burrowed, and the sea fell in at the visitations of the waves. As the tide came in, the castles crumbled and were taken out. They built more, further in, huddled together with their tools, patting rooftops, making grainy drawbridges, their skin getting browner in the heat. Dusk fell blue and quiet on the mountains, and there were evening birds. Only then did they make their way back, the children finally acquiescing, allowing themselves to be led away from the shore to the square, white, cool-floored house, to a late meal around the long dining table, the dark Spanish night so close and strange at the windows as they slept. The following evening, the children were put to bed early, as Stephanie wanted to maintain some semblance of order and normality amidst the debauchery of late-night drinking and music, which the girls, sparkled by donut sugar and Pete's endless offerings of Haribos, were often privy to at the top of the stairs, eavesdropping. They had heard the conversations about the resurgence of fascism in the West. They had heard the argument about the superiority of Foxy Brown over Lil' Kim. They had heard it when Hazel had announced that she liked having her big toe sucked during lovemaking, and everyone had since been instructed to keep their voices down, there being no doors separating the staircase from the lounge. Now it was after 11. There was a bottle of vodka being worked through on the coffee table. Damien was outside smoking, while the others were splayed across the sofa and armchairs, Michael on his phone, Melissa and Hazel playing a game of blackjack. Stephanie was watching a bad Spanish drama on TV during an interlude from the wine and cards, when there came a sudden rush of activity down the stairs, a flurry of pajamas and gowns, Summer, then Rhea, holding Avril's hand. Avril had a desperate look on her face.
"Mum, there's something wrong with Avril,"
Summer said.
"She keeps saying she wants to go home."
Stephanie stood and looked her over. Avril immediately clutched onto her, squeezing the fabric of her dress.
"What's wrong, darling?"
she said.
"Please, let me go home. Please, Mummy."
The tone in her voice was shrill and unnerving, like someone being hounded. Stephanie hugged her and stroked her back.
"But we can't go home now, honey. It's too late. We're going back on Saturday. Why do you want to go home all of a sudden?" "I just do."
She burst into tears, just as Damien came in from the garden and asked what was wrong.
"Gosh, you're shivering," Stephanie said. "Look, come here. It's all right. It's all right."
She carried on rubbing Avril's back and up and down her arms, crouching in front of her. But this didn't seem to help. Her eyes maintained that wild, petrified look, and her breathing quickened.
"What's wrong with her?"
Stephanie asked Damien, raising her voice. He went and got hold of Avril's hands. She gazed right through him, breathing frantically. The expression on her face reminded him of the night she'd found him trying to leave. He carried her to the armchair, sat her down, and told her, "Avril, listen now. The plane to take us home is ready on Saturday. Then we can go home. The plane's not ready right now, okay? So we're going to stay here until then and have some more fun, okay?"
"But, Mummy, I can't breathe."
This sent Stephanie into a frenzy. She grabbed hold of her child and pulled her close.
"Get some water, someone,"
she cried.
"Oh my God, what's happening? What's wrong with her? What's wrong with my baby?"
"I think it's a panic attack," Hazel said.
"I used to get like that sometimes when I was younger."
Panic attacks, coming from a family where outward expressions of mental extremity were uncommon, were non-existent in Stephanie's pool of parenting knowledge. She knew what the best hay fever tablets were,
and how to bazooka a verruca and what to do about chickenpox. But she did not know how to simmer anxious shivering or restore the ability to breathe, and her futility in this scenario she found terrifying. She lashed out at Damien.
It's because of you! She wasn't like this before! You've made her! We've...
Steph.
No, it's true! I know about this! They can feel it when there's tension. It makes them frightened, doesn't it? Oh, darling, it's all right. It's all right. You're fine. Everything will be fine. Shh. Come here.
It was clear that Stephanie was not the best person to comfort Avril, but she wouldn't let go of her. Damien went to get a glass of water. He stood uselessly watching as Stephanie stroked her head, rocked her, trying to calm her down at the same time. Hazel gathered some cushions on the sofa.
Let her just sit down quietly. She'll be fine.
She just has to feel safe.
If we all be calm, she'll be calm too.
Show her the yoga breathing, Liz.
And it was easier, Avril found, concentrating on sitting still like this, concentrating on breathing in and out from the pit of her belly. Eventually, she settled down. It was like a crashing wave changing its mind inside her and slowly turning back. Maybe it would not take her all the way out after all. Maybe she would be safe, and the castle would not be washed away. She lay her head on the arm of the sofa and felt her mother smoothing her hair, making her sleepy, saying her voice high and thin.
Shh. Shh. Shh.
When she was calm again, her eyes beginning to close, Damien carried her back upstairs. Watching him go, Melissa felt sorry for him, the defeat and sadness in his shoulders, yet that warm paternal strength that endured regardless. She was still thinking of this when she was laying awake next to Michael in the small hours of the night. She had been falling in and out of sleep. She had had a strange, brief dream, almost just one image, of Damien leaning over her in the darkness, his thick torso, his large hands carrying her in some way, and there was water all around them. There was a sense that the water was very cold, but they themselves were warm within it, and that this heat was coming from his body. It was such a rich, immediate image that turning to find Michael's exposed back next to her, expanding and sinking with his breathing, made her disorientated. She heard a noise coming from downstairs, like a chair being moved, and wondered if it was Damien. When she went down, she found Stephanie sitting at the kitchen table in her dressing gown, drinking black coffee. She was disappointed. She had imagined talking to him again in this quiet night, darkness, just the two of them. She wanted to tell him something, something that no one else would understand.
Coffee, at this time?
It helps me sleep. I'm backwards, literally.
What do you mean?
Stephanie shook her head, dropping her chin into her hands. She was still upset about Avril.
I was a mess before. I was ridiculous. I couldn't have handled it more badly, could I?
Don't be silly. You're overwhelmed.
But I should have known what to do. I didn't know what to do.
Stephanie. Melissa dropped a chamomile tea bag into her cup and came and sat down. You can't expect to always be the perfect mother in every situation, in everything that happens. It's not feasible. Take me, for instance. I remember once I didn't even know the right thing to do when Rhea had a high temperature. I kept putting more clothes on her, thinking she was cold.
Really?
She laughed with a hint of scorn. There was a passing coolness between them. Stephanie began explaining, in a distant, more vulnerable tone.
It's all I ever wanted, you know? The children. To look after them, raise them well. To bring them into this terrible world and make them shine in it and make it brighter. When they were babies, I remember there was this feeling of impermanence. It's all new. You're so afraid. You're thinking only of keeping them alive and seeing that they're healthy and growing. Later, it's different though. It gets more complicated when they're leaning towards their own independent selves and there's less you can do to save them. That frightens me more. I can't always be what they need anymore. I can't help them. I know you think I'm a dinosaur, don't you?
Melissa shrugged.
that's just who you are.
Yes, but it's so frightening.
And there's that question as well of what happens afterwards, when they're fully grown, taking up space in the world, when they really don't need you, hardly ever.
There was something about Stephanie's singular commitment to the work of motherhood that nevertheless troubled Melissa. Even as she admired its focus, its confidence, it seemed to point to an inadequacy within herself, a possibility that she was suppressing in herself. A part of her wanted to kill this thing in Stephanie. She wanted to smash her house to pieces, to break it open and force her out of it, so that everything entrenched would be thrown into the air and land differently, making new ways of living, new ways of growing.
"What will you be then?" she asked her.
"When all your work of raising is finally done, will you remember yourself? How to get back to yourself? How much of yourself do you get to keep?"
Stephanie now studied Melissa, the way a grandmother might look at a child, wishing her a greater wisdom, further away in time, an ability to let go of something inside held far too tightly, yet wondering also at her own self that she had let go, and how far back that was, trying to trace it, knowing it was impossible, unnecessary.
"Who knows about all that?" she said. "I'll just find something else to be."
She laughed again.
"You do think I'm a dinosaur." "Actually, in a way, I envy you."
"Why?"
"Because you're patient with your life. You're not trying to be everything at once." "I've got to be someone's wife as well, though."
Melissa lifted her cup, waited before drinking. This is what she had wanted to tell Damien, but the words came out by themselves. As soon as she'd said them, she regretted it.
"Michael wants to get married."
"Oh?"
Stephanie smiled.
"Did he ask you?"
"We've been talking about it. He says it's time. He said last night that we've reached the point where we either get married or split."
I understand."
"So,
you're asking me?"
"Well, I'm not sure."
And Stephanie, in turn, wanted to kill this thing in Melissa, the thing that clung to the opaque, the intangible, to mere possibility. Be a solid person, a whole woman halved. Be firm and tethered and tied to something solid.
"We'll do it," she said. "Make the commitment. Accept this for all that it is, warts and all. Then you can just be happy instead of fighting and questioning all the time. Go on, put him out of his misery."
For the next 2 days, it rained. It rained almost continually. Between bouts of weak sunshine, not strong enough to conjure rainbows, a gliding, gentle drizzle that made a shushing sound in the air, a susurrus rising up from the ground. The beach was damp and deserted, and the boys were lonely. The pool seemed wetter, colder, though its surface was broken occasionally by the boldest of the children, Rhea and Jerry, who could not see how rain could be a deterrent, it falling around you as you were submerged, making water complete. On the third day, a rainbow did emerge, spectacularly, on the wings of a new blast of sun, and not just one, but two. A double arch of multicolour road against the background blue, the sun itself a neat apricot glow, like a great lost earring, risen from the gloom. The children ran outside to receive it. Slowly the heat sucked the water from the grass, the yellowed cotton of the Heineken parasol dried, and the barbecue was dragged out from its sheltering bush, ready for the final Friday night fiesta. For this highlight of the holiday, they bought stacks of meat, kebab sticks, corn cobs, potatoes and leaves for other salads. Burger buns and hot dog buns, and drinks, of course, more drinks. The supplies had been drained in the rainy nights over long games of blackjack and another game called Pile of Shit. Michael and Pete had stayed up all night yesterday and slept in until lunch, emerging loose-faced and delicate. More beer, more rum, more whiskey, more chasers.
"How much drink do we need?"
Stephanie exclaimed.
"Don't worry, it will all find an orifice,"
Hazel said, unpacking in the kitchen, finding fridge space and temporary freezer space to get it cold faster. They started drinking early, as drumsticks flamed on the grill, the coals working hard, as streaks of belly pork seeped their salty juices, as fish congealed and warmed in its foil. Towards evening, the sun walked away across the grass in a dark green cloak, leaving it crunchy again. Michael and Pete nursed their hangovers with Red Stripe. Pete at the barbecue, head chef, Michael his sidekick, both of them collusive, boyish, constantly joking. Damien felt left out, forgotten. Was his aptitude for humour inadequate? Was he less of a pal to Michael than he had thought? All the more reason why the sight of Melissa coming down the stairs as he was again slipping away for a slice of Tolstoy seemed an easier and lovely thing. She was wearing a yellow polka-dot dress with a white collar. Her hair was loose, no earrings.
"You look nice,"
he said.
"Thanks. That dress suits you."
"Thanks." He couldn't seem to stop the flow of his thoughts to his mouth. Perhaps it was Pete's punch, which he had been sipping since 3. It was such a punch that it tasted like strong raspberry squash, with a splash of petrol thrown in. Now, in its rich, fruity haze, Damien no longer considered his feelings for Melissa as a crush. No, it was more than that. All the times at the beach, he had been trying not to compare her to Stephanie. The springy physicality of her, the pretty feet, the yoga tone, the way she ate a donut, as if she were not eating a donut. Whereas when Stephanie ate a donut, she looked as if she was eating a donut. All week, lying across the hall from her, had made a new dimension of her in his mind. The sound of the shower water had a Melissa sound. There were Melissa footsteps on the stairs. Her shapes were in the shadows. Her voice was in the atmosphere, like a softly singing breeze.
"I feel a bit strange," she said.
"I hardly ever wear dresses. I thought I'd make an effort for our last night." She touched her naked earlobe, a sea of silver bracelets around the raised wrist. "Blake's down, thank God, so I can party in peace. The plan is to get them all down as soon as possible so we're free for debauchery. You ready?"
"I'm just going to change my shirt."
"Okay, but if you're planning on reading, I don't think Hazel's going to put up with any of that tonight. Tolstoy et al. Are not invited." She tapped him fondly on the head and swept past him with a hint of body mist into the clamour of Nirvana, which was playing from Michael's iPod. There was already a small disco taking place by a pillar. Summer was teaching Hazel and Avril, who was happier now she had come round to the BTIC, a hip-hop dance routine, interspersed with them taking it in turns to do moves that the others copied. Chicken bones were scattered on random plates. The grill was still going, the embers mellow.
"I want to stay up all night," Rhea said.
"Can we?"
"You cannot," Stephanie confirmed. But only close to 11 did the children finally retreat from the upper stair, at last bored with the meandering talk of drunken adults rising up through the villa. Their pontifications on ways of disciplining children, their gossiping on uninteresting media personalities and house prices, their earnest critical appraisals and recollections of movies they hadn't seen. Exhausted, they fell into their beds, dreaming of air flight, England-bound, their own beds empty. Silent, waiting for them when the plane emerged downwards from the clouds, heading for home.
"Know what I feel like doing?" Hazel said. "I feel like going for a swim."
"You? You can't swim," said Melissa.
"I can just dip."
"Come with me. Go on."
"No," she shrugged her off. "I don't feel like swimming at this moment. I feel like sitting right here in this warm, dry chair and being comfortable."
"Don't let her swim. She's drunk. She might drown."
Stephanie was also beyond her usual limit. She felt like dancing. Michael Jackson came on, and she did, bopping behind the sofa, holding her wine. The two big black and white table lamps on the sideboard were switched on, giving a copper hue. The door to the garden was open beyond the arch. In the bounce of PYT, the conversation moved on to Michael Jackson himself, the 50-date tour he had coming up.
"He's not going to do all those shows," Hazel said.
"No way. He can't even sing anymore, I heard. How's he going to do 50 dates?
"He might," said Pete. "He must need the money."
Michael said, "It's a publicity ploy to get him back into the spotlight. It doesn't even matter if he can't sing. People just want to see him because he's him."
Hazel said, topping up her drink,
"Well, I heard he's loco anyway. My friend works for his management. She said she went to his house once, and he answered the door with lipstick smeared all over his face."
"What? Neverland?" said Damien.
"Yeah."
"Your friend went to Neverland?"
"Apparently, yeah."
"Wow. What was that like?"
"I don't know. I'll ask her if you like."
Hazel said this with an element of sarcasm. She didn't like Damien much. He was too intense and a bit weird. Meanwhile, Michael Jackson shrieked in the speakers. He said, "Shaman!" and "Woohoo!" It was Wannabe starting something, the opening song of Thriller. Heads were nodding, shoulders moving.
"Is anyone going? How much are tickets?"
"A wanna, a tour maybe?
Pete's taking me.
A friend of mine sorted me out."
"Lucky cow."
Stephanie sat down on the sofa arm at the opposite end to Damien, throwing back her wine. Since the episode with Avril, they had been civil with one another, avoiding any more embarrassing confrontations that might upset her again. They were like two acquaintances at a party.
"The poor man," she said. "I feel sorry for him. Do you think he did it? Molested those children?"
"There's no smoke without fire,"
Hazel said, as Jackson sighed and cooed and gasped, as he screeched and whooped and hee-heed and audibly skipped.
"Ow!"
he went.
Melissa said, "Listen to him, man. There's just no one like him. No one shrieks like that."
She got up to dance.
"I love this song."
She was clapping, making slidey steps with her feet.
"What exactly is he saying here? Is he saying, you're a vegetable? I've always wondered about that."
Damien watched her secretly, the copper-lit pool of her throat and her whirling polka-dot waist. He had put on a good shirt, short sleeves, patterned, hopefully highlighting the work he had been doing this week on his musculature. He got to his feet as well and bent his legs in time with the music, bringing his hips into it. The music was a drug. Jackson dancing with them in his shiny white suit.
"Shaman! Ow!"
He was in the room. The lightning of his legs, the moon in his feet, and the one white bright hand. It was a unique cinematic music, a seething energy and electricity, a voice they all knew, from a time they all knew.
"One thing about Michael Jackson, though," Michael said.
"He always seemed happy with his teeth. It's the one thing he didn't seem to want to change about himself."
"How do you know he didn't change them?"
Hazel shouted over the noise.
"He must have changed them. He's American. All Americans get their teeth done, especially if they're famous."
"Why are you talking about him in the past tense?"
Damien said, followed by Melissa, drunkenness consuming her. Oh, this most joyous of drugs.
"It's kind of fitting in a way. He is past tense, of himself, I mean. He's a different person to the one he was born as."
Stephanie, who was practical about matters of the soul, said,
"We all are, aren't we? We're all different from who we started as. I would hope so, anyway."
She believed in maturity, in the concept of the grown-up, not the inner child. But Melissa disagreed.
"Or are we just the same? I always think of myself as 15. When I was 15, I decided I didn't want to get any older than that, so I didn't.
I think we're static inside. It's deviation from this static state that causes pain and friction."
"Everyone has to grow up sometime,"
Michael said, which grated on her, as if he were talking specifically about her, which he was.
"Yeah," said Pete. "In your teens, you get chirps in your 20s and get laid. In your 30s, you get married. In your 40s, you get..."
"Me? I'm never getting married," Melissa said. "I don't want to be anyone's wife. What a horrible word that is anyway."
"Don't you think husband is a so much nicer word than wife?"
"What happens in your 40s? Hazel said.
"Liz, you talk such rubbish sometimes. Ignore her, Michael."
He had shot Melissa a quick, dark look, a wince in the eyes. Then it was gone.
He swigged on his drink. He'd meant it, about this being the time to do it or split. She could make light of it, but he'd meant it.
In your 40s you get old, innit? Then the whole thing starts all over again.
After you get divorced, Michael finished for Pete. Thriller, the song itself, came on. Everyone was up this time except for Michael, who didn't feel like dancing now, and Melissa danced with Damien, not quite opposite him. There was a drift of heat as they thrillered around each other. He actually danced well. He danced, in fact, better than Michael did, with her, the good medium height of him, closer, his chunk of stomach, the hunger in his eyes, those thick hands caught in the beat. She remembered the dream of him above her, so vivid, carrying her like he'd carried Avril up the stairs. And she had a powerful longing to be engulfed by him, to be centered in his unfamiliar warmth. What would it feel like? What would those hands feel like? Hazel and Pete were also dancing together. Stephanie was swaying by the pillar like before, half holding onto it, the ceiling swinging back and forth. They all staggered, two-stepped and stamped. Hazel was laughing her head off trying to do the moves from the Thriller video.
How do you know all the moves? She asked Pete. Come on, everyone knows the moves to Thriller.
Forwards, they stamped like the zombies. They became a mess of feet going left and arms going right, like in the video when Michael and the zombies gather into one dance routine. Hazel couldn't take it anymore, and she flung herself down on the sofa. Melissa, Damien, and Pete kept going, Pete dragging Michael up. He bopped for a while, noncommittal. He had not registered the sparks of terrible yearning charging out at Melissa from Damien's eyes just then. The loss in him. At that moment, when the break came in, and the pitch increased of all scruples, all worry of propriety and consequence. The dancing got more and more wild. Pete was goggling his eyes. Melissa was shaking her head in fast motion. Damien was bouncing around her. When the song was over, they fell about in their chairs, sweating, apart from Stephanie, who announced that she was going to bed.
No, Hazel said. No one's allowed to go to bed early.
It's not early, it's almost 2.
Yes, early. To you, maybe, Miss Drink Everyone Under the Table, but I'm beat. Beat it. Get it? Ha ha ha. Anyway, I feel sick. I think I'm going to...
She put her hand on her stomach and rushed upstairs to the bathroom.
Some people have no stomach, Hazel said. Oh my God, I'm so drunk, Melissa moaned. I know. Let's play a game, Hazel said.
Doesn't she ever reach that point where you've just, like, had enough?
Michael asked Pete.
What kind of game? Pete said.
Hazel had poured herself more vodka. She was sitting with her legs slung over Pete's lap. By now, they had a nickname, H.P. Sauce. She gulped the drink straight, no chaser.
Let's play that game where everyone tells a bit of a story. Remember, Liz? We used to play it when we bunked off school.
Nah, I'm rubbish at those kinds of games,
Michael said, his hand resting on Melissa's thigh in a determined gesture of ownership.
It doesn't matter. Let's just try it. I'll start.
Everyone waited half-heartedly for Hazel to begin. The music was still playing, but lower. The night thick-set and mild around the villa. There were cool, original Doritos on the coffee table, unanimously agreed as being a quality crisp.
Okay, here goes, she said. One day in the forests of Papua New Guinea, a little boy tripped over a rock and hurt his foot. Your turn, Pete.
Okay,
Pete said, assuming a confident narrative tone.
Ouch, that hurt, he exclaimed with aplomb.
There was sniggering at the use of this word.
The boy's name was Johannes, and he didn't have any plasters on him.
Hazel was laughing and clutching Pete's bicep.
You next, Damien.
So to stop the flow of blood, he ripped off a bit of his T-shirt, which pained him because it was his favourite, Ben 10,
and wrapped it around the wound.
But alas, Michael said dramatically, the cut was bleeding so much that the butt flimsy piece of fabric was soaked through in seconds, and Johannes realized, just before it fell off, his foot, that is, that it was more damaged than he had at first thought.
Everyone laughed.
That wasn't bad, dude, said Pete.
That was one of those situations where you smash it because you thought you were going to be shit, so you tried harder, innit?
Now, Melissa, she continued. Poor, poor Johannes was so upset having only one foot that he threw himself down on the ground and wept. Then he heard a voice.
Hark!
The voice said from the foresty air. This was Hazel, on the tail of a huge yawn.
Do not weep, for I am your insect godmother, and I have come to save you.
Go on, sweet thing.
You have, Johannes said. Wow, that's ace. I thought I was really done for then. After that time in Mendoza, Argentina, when my nose fell off, I didn't think I was going to get any more chances. I thought I was going to have to hop to the nearest hospital holding my foot. Wouldn't that have been a drag? So, what do you want me to do?
Said Pete. Damien had his turn. Then Michael flashed the godmother's wand, sending Johannes back to Leytonstone, and Damien giggled as Melissa told of how glad he was to be back in the hood. But the price he'd paid for his freedom was that he had two left feet and limped. Michael's arm was slung lazily over the back of the sofa behind Melissa. She was leaning against him, but she kept gazing out at Damien in such a way, or so he thought, that he felt incapable of going upstairs and leaving the two couples to their own private games of love. She seemed to be speaking to him with her eyes, asking him for something.
Ah, so you know what he did,
Hazel said, yawning again, for she wanted to go into her room now and eat Pete.
What?
They said.
Oh, I can't think any more. Okay, he went to the nearest barber with his funny limp and said he was looking for work. The manager gave him a job cleaning the floors and the customer toilet. Meanwhile, Johannes' parents were really worried.
Indeed, Michael said,
for they hadn't seen their son in 6 months, and they didn't believe the police's institutionally racist theory that he must have run away from home, seeing as he'd had an important football match the day after his disappearance.
And so, Melissa began,
our sweetness come to bed, it's time for gravity.
Oh, I see, now you've had enough. You're not allowed to go to bed until the party's over, your rule.
Who said the party's over? Hazel was standing now, holding Pete's hand, her drink in the other.
Come on, hon, let's chip.
And Pete let himself be dragged up. He followed her, hazy, shiny looks on their faces, staggering as they went. He put his arm around her to steady them both as they bid their good nights. They looked so rich and young together, as if gravity could not hold them, even if it tried. Like rustic angels, untouchable by mortal concerns. And Michael remembered that this was what love could do to you. He asked Melissa if she was coming up.
I might have some chamomile first, she said.
Actually, she wanted a cigarette. She felt like smoking a cigarette with Damien in the snow cocoon.
Okay.
Peace. Michael touched Damien on the fist. He didn't look at Melissa again. Soon she could hear his footsteps in the room above. A silence, a familiar waiting. She didn't want to go. Outside, Damien lit up a Marlboro light. He would have just this one smoke, he told him.